Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to The Academic Life, a podcast series here on New Books Network. I'm Dr. Christina Gessler, the host of the channel. Today, we'll be talking to our guest, Elizabeth Bunce, about her book, Premeditated Myrtle, and her work as a children's book writer. Welcome to the podcast, Elizabeth.
Thanks for having me.
I am really glad you're here. I'm so excited that we get to talk about this career path for listeners. To start, would you please tell us a bit about yourself?
So I feel like I should have a better pat answer for this, but I'm going to start by saying that I'm a native Midwesterner, and I've been living in the Kansas City metro for the last 20 years, right on the edge of the old prairie. And in my cozy house full of animals, I write and I make things. I am a maker, a seamstress, a needlewoman, not a baker. There has been no COVID bread making in this household, I am sorry to say. And that, I think, sums up my quick bio.
Well, that is a lovely bio, and it leads to the next question, which is, can you tell us a bit about your own educational path?
So, sure. I grew up in Iowa. That's probably a little earlier in the educational path than you were anticipating, but I've known since I was a kid that I wanted to be an author. Strangely, wasn't until I was about 14 or 15 and early in high school that I realized that the books that I loved were written by real people as a job and that I could do that too. And that is the point at which I promptly stopped taking math. And from that point on, I sort of aimed myself in that direction. And I went to the University of Iowa and majored in English. But along the way, I also discovered a real passion for the social science of anthropology. And so along with my English major, I had an anthropology major. And this was in an era when college academic life was really starting to take an interest in an interdisciplinary approach to various studies. So there were lots of courses in my curriculum that counted for both my anthropology major and my English major. And those are the ones that I was really most interested in. One that pops to mind is my coursework in Icelandic literature. We studied all the great Viking stories that have now been put on TV. And that, I think, was sort of crucial to me in my development as a historical fiction and historical fantasy writer. Because on the one hand, I was getting the really solid foundation in literature and critical thinking. And then on the other hand, I was getting this wonderful insight into culture and society. And I thought I had wanted to major in history, but I couldn't get into the history class I wanted. And so my fiance at the time, now my husband, suggested that I take this Anthropology 101, which was Introduction to Physical Anthropology. And I was hooked immediately. I realized it wasn't history so much that I was interested in, major political events, but anthropology, the lives of regular people and what existence was like at various points in history. And that has really formed the foundation of the work that I do and the way that I write and the way that I approach the types of things that I write, whether it's fantasy or the straight historical fiction that I'm doing right now.
And did your course of study offer classes, particularly on the craft of writing for children, or how did you develop the skills for that particular area of work? Because it is, well, good writing is good writing across all genres. The skills of writing for children are also an added layer of skills.
Well, the skills of writing fiction, I think, are what probably was the least focus of what of excuse me of the English side of the education. At the time, there were not a lot of undergraduate fiction courses available at the University of Iowa, because the focus, of course, is on the Iowa Writers Workshop, which is the graduate program. And so I did take what I could and realized very quickly that not only was I the only children's writer, I was the only fantasy writer. And so I did feel a little bit out of step with the other students as we were studying. But there's always a value in communing with other writers about writing, and particularly in reading outside your own genre, reading widely, and as you say, studying the craft of good writing in whatever form that it might take. So I think a lot of the study that I've done in terms of writing for children has actually happened outside of the classroom. I think there are more programs, more resources available now than maybe there were back when I was studying. I'm always studying. We're all always studying. We're all always learning our craft. But I mean, back in when I was in college. So nowadays, well, probably it's been around forever. I just wasn't aware of it at the time. There's the Vermont College has a very highly respected graduate program for children's writers. And that is something that they have. It's a low residency program. And if you're interested in pursuing sort of an advanced degree, they offer a master's of fine arts in creative writing for children. But that was not my path. My path involved finishing college and being a little bit, frankly, I was burnt out. I had had a double major packed with credits. I wanted to learn as much as I could every minute I was in school. And at the same time, my fiance was going through law school, and it felt like I was going through law school at the same time. And so by the time that 4 very intense years ended, I needed a break. And I also was uncertain about what I wanted to pursue in terms of graduate study, whether I wanted to continue on studying literature at a graduate level, or whether I wanted to go into anthropology, archaeology, forensic anthropology, or even I had a minor in museum studies. And all of those decisions would have meant heading off in a different direction geographically, financially. And I was ready to write. So when we graduated, I got married, and I took my very portable career across country to the Portland, Oregon area, where my husband started his law career. And while he was a young lawyer, I was a young writer. And it has worked out really brilliantly since then. I've done some early on, I did some technical writing as sort of a moneymaker, because it does take quite a bit of time to support yourself before you get published. So I did that for a while, but I haven't done that in many years, and I haven't had to do that in many years. But I will say that if you are interested in a career as a technical writer, English and anthropology is probably not the strongest foundation for that. I think communications and journalism, you'll have a better shot at getting jobs.
So if you can take us back to the leap then, from writing that you knew for sure was going to pay you to getting your first novel out there, what was the path to getting your first book published like?
Well, it was a long path. because as with any skill, it can take, what do they say, like 10,000 hours of practice, which amounts, I think before the days of self-publishing, the average was something like, it took most writers about 10 years to produce something that was really strong enough to be published. And if I was better at math, I could do that calculation, but I think it was something similar for me. So I was writing constantly. I considered it my career. I considered it my job. I tried to treat it as my job, even before I was published. And I had projects in mind, and I had finished at least one novel, many, many parts of novels, some short stories, until in 2002, an idea popped into my head for a retelling of the fairy tale Rumpelstiltskin. And as soon as I had it, I did something I had never done before. And that was, I told my husband about it. And I said, I think I have a really good idea. And I said, I want to do a retelling of Rumpelstiltskin set in a woolen mill. And he said, that is a good idea. And I said, I thought so too. And so that was the book, A Curse Dark as Gold, which was my first published novel. And that book took, so 2002 is when I started writing it. And 2008 is when it came out. But it went through the publication process, was several years of that. So I think that I sold the book in 2005, and it just took another 2.5 years to make it through the editorial and publication and marketing process before it actually was released. So I write long books with a lot of research and background that goes into them. So they do take a little bit of time. And there's also a sense of the slow burn of ideas that I like. You know, it might take 9 months for those plot threads to finally tie together. And so that is sort of explains the length of time to write a book. You know, we always say that a book takes, how long does it take to write a book? As long as it takes. So the leap to, I will admit that there was not a tremendous, for me in my situation, it didn't feel like a tremendous financial risk, because the technical writing gigs that I was getting were few and far between. And so I really had the benefit of a second income in my household that could support us while I was getting my career off the ground. And I know that's not an option for everybody, but I feel incredibly fortunate that it was there when we needed it. And then I had an incredibly supportive partnership in my husband that, I could not ask for a stronger cheerleader, first fan, first reader. And it's been fantastic.
That is one of my questions about the writing life. It is solitary. You have to have uninterrupted time. You have to be able to sit with what I call my imaginary friends, and play with them on the page and see how it's going to go. But too much solitary time becomes defeating. We need community when we write, whatever field we write in, whatever genre we write for, whether it's strictly academic writing, whether we do creative writing, we still need a community of like-minded writers. How did you find and build a writing support community?
So around the time that I was working on Curse, A Curse Dark as Gold, the Rumpelstiltskin story, I was getting to a point in my life that felt like a crossroads. And I think a lot of women get to this point. And I was getting close to being 30, and I had neither a full-time flourishing career yet, nor did I have children. And I thought I needed to achieve something, to really focus on one of those things. And I had always known that writing was going to be my focus. And so I decided I was going to buckle down and figure out what I needed to do to get published. And I actually lucked into a book, and I'm sorry, I'm turning around right now to look at my bookshelf. So give me one second.
Okay.
I found a book at either a garage sale or Half Price Books, or someone gave it to me. It was a book published in the 90s or late 90s called Writing for Young Adults. And I knew that was what I was trying to do. And it mentioned SCBWI, which is the Society for Children's Book Writers and Illustrators. And I had never heard of this group, but I immediately went online and found them. And I discovered that there wasn't a chapter close to us in Kansas City at the time, but there was an internet message board. And I was very comfortable with internet message boards because they had been a large part, as you say, of my community building with other needle women. And at the time we had a retired racing greyhound. And so I was on a board for retired racing greyhounds. And so I joined SCBWI and I joined their message boards, and I found some other writers here in Kansas City, and they clued me in to an organization for children's writers in the Kansas City metro that has been going on since the mid-1980s. The name of the group now is Juvenile Writers. No, I'm sorry, that's the original name, Juvenile Writers of Kansas City. The name now is Heartland Writers for Kids and Teens. And I immediately started attending meetings of the local chapter, or the only chapter of that group. I started going. They have met continuously since on Wednesday mornings. They have a critique group, and we're doing it by Zoom since the pandemic, and it's hard to say whether we'll go back to in-person meetings, although we all really desperately miss seeing each other and passing out manuscripts. But our moderator, Judy Hyde, reads every manuscript aloud cold, and it's brilliant. You know, when you constantly hear your own work inside your own head, it sounds perfect. But when someone who's never looked at your sentences before reads them aloud, you can immediately tell whether they're awkward or clunky or sound right, or you've used too many ings in a paragraph, or you used the word look 11 times in two pages. So so they're the Wednesday morning group that I thank in the acknowledgments to Premeditated Myrtle, because that process, Myrtle is the only book that I ever brought every single chapter to group week by week as I was writing it. The process of bringing a novel through a weekly critique group can be kind of daunting, because it's a little bit challenging to get a sense of the pacing of the book. So it necessarily makes the pacing feel much more protracted and slow and plodding, even if that's not really the case on the page. You know, if you had the whole manuscript in your hand to read in one sitting, it would feel a lot quicker. But the value of having that community, having that group of fellow writers of all levels. We have members who are writing their very first pieces of prose or poetry ever in their lives. We have people who are highly published. One of our members has been the poet laureate of the state of Kansas. So we are at all levels of our craft and writing every genre of work for young readers, from picture books and poetry for the youngest of young readers, well up into young adult. So that, I would say that's probably been the biggest blessing of my writing career, is having that local group. And of course, now there are so many places to reach out to fellow writers online. And, you know, every time I do a conference, every time I'm on a panel, I meet new writers and continue to build that sense of community and a sense of we're all in this very strange boat together. Right now, I've made my very first foreign sales, which involves so much confusing tax material. And like I said, I stopped taking math when I was 15. So wading through the 18 pages of instructions for the foreign tax manual, it's really nice to have other people to say, hey, how does this work again? And you know, my agent sent my manuscript out 2 weeks ago. We haven't heard anything yet, and I'm dying of suspense. Can someone help? That sort of thing is lovely.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
So you've spoken about the community in your home, that you are very well partnered with a supportive husband, and it sounds like you have a good workspace there in your home with books and the quiet you need to work.
Yes, it's called my bedroom.
There you go. And you have your local writing community. You've joined the international organization SCBWI. And now you've touched on another piece that is often part of a writer's support group, which is having an agent and an agency. And you thank them in the final back matter of the book. And you thank the Aaron Murphy Literary Agency. Can you talk a bit about the path to getting an agent and why that's part of your support system? Because not all children's book writers and not all writers of any genre, name the genre, do have an agent.
So I have been, now I will admit that in the last 15 years since I have been publishing, the field of publishing has changed dramatically. When I started in, let's say 2002, when I started writing Curse, there was no Kindle. There was no people who self-published memoirs and local interest recipe books. And it was looked down on a little bit by people who were traditionally published, because you don't have that sort of editorial process with all of the gatekeepers that you have to go through. Well, that has completely changed. And the world of publishing is so much more populist and democratic now that we have so many more opportunities for more people to get their voices out there. But it also means the marketplace is more crowded. And in the last few years, particularly, actually, we just got news within the last week or so that, as in every business, the number of publishing houses keeps shrinking. They keep buying each other and I'm not thinking of the word that I want, but you know, when multiple companies that used to be separate are now part of one entity, that means the loss of editors and sometimes a more competitive marketplace when a publisher is putting out books that might compete with each other. And so having a knowledgeable business partner who can navigate those aspects of things, I've found invaluable. So when I started, I thought I wanted an agent because I didn't really feel comfortable approaching editors on my own. But it turns out I'm actually really good at that part, and I really like meeting new editors. So having the agent as a business partner is really nice, because it allows an author to focus on, more of the craft as you're working, because that's the nuts and bolts of what we do, is, the selling a manuscript, negotiating contracts. Those are all a huge part of the business side of being a professional writer, an author. But it's not a fun part, and it's a part that takes a huge amount of energy and knowledge and wisdom and experience. And all of that takes away from the already sort of energy sapping part of that is making wonderful books. So how I got my agent time was I met her at a conference. And that is a very common way of making those connections in the children's literature world and other parts of traditional publishing. Organizations like SCBWI regularly put on national and regional conferences that bring in national talent, editors, agents, other authors. And at those events, often the editors and agents who attend will accept brief submissions. They'll either accept complete submissions from the agent, from the participants. So, for example, my agency, the Aaron Murphy Literary Agency, is a closed agency, so you can't just blindly submit to them. But if you go to a conference where one of the agents is on the faculty, then you have an invitation to submit to them. And I met Aaron at a conference that we held here in Kansas City in 2004. And she read part of Curse, which was then called Charlotte Miller. And now she and I tell this story differently. She says that she read the manuscript and she really enjoyed my partial, which is like your first three chapters and a synopsis and maybe a little query letter that explains, sort of introduces yourself and your project to the editor or agent who's looking at it. So she had read my partial and says that, you know, and she really enjoyed it and she had lovely things to say about it. And the way Aaron tells the story, I said I wasn't ready for an agent. That seems like a colossally foolish thing to say to an agent. And I can't imagine that I said it, but I walked away from that meeting with very positive feedback from her, but no deal. But I realized how much I loved, it had been my first writer's conference, and I realized how much I loved the energy, the excitement, the communion with other authors and with meeting people in the business, on the business side, the editors and the agents. So I immediately started signing up for as many writing conferences as I could find in places where I would be likely to travel. And at another SCBWI regional conference, this one was in Arizona in 2005, I met Cheryl Klein, who was with Scholastic, who would become my first editor. She also read a partial of Curse. And said, so backtracking just a slight bit here, the conventional wisdom, every aspiring author is told, don't bring your full manuscript to the conference because no one is going to read it. You have to wait to be invited. And I am a very, very conscientious rule following person. So of course I only brought what I was told to bring, which was my partial. And I had a critique with Cheryl Klein. And what she said was, do you have the rest of the manuscript? I would love to read it on the plane home. I was like,
no. Oh my goodness.
Sorry?
I said, oh my goodness.
I was like, no, I don't have the rest of the manuscript because everyone says not to do that. So from that point, Cheryl would email me every couple of months asking me if I was finished with the book yet. And when I finally was finished, I sent it off to her. And somehow around that same time, I had submitted another project to Erin Murphy. And we got, so that was sort of the too long didn't read part of the story is I went to conferences. I met an agent. I met an editor. They liked my work. They invited me to submit, and we all ended up working together on my first three books were with Scholastic, and they were with as we were talking about the consolidation of publishing companies and how businesses change and evolve. Those books were with the imprint Arthur A. Levine Books at Scholastic, which no longer exists because Cheryl left to become the editorial director at Lee & Low. And then Arthur left to found a new publishing house of his own. And so those books are now sort of orphans at Scholastic. I don't have an editor or really even a contact person anymore over there, but I have a new publisher now who was found for me by my agent for the Myrtle Hardcastle Mysteries. And that has been, so it's like in any corporate life, moving from company to company, the culture is very different. And, you know, your coworkers really matter. And even if you only email your coworkers every 6 weeks or so, that those relationships can really make or break your career.
That's a fantastic story. People who know the children's lit world will be really interested because the names that you just named are luminaries, basically. So,
let me name another one. My current editor is Elise Howard. And I'm not sure she gets quite as much buzz around her name, but she is first class all the way. She's been in the business. She talks about being a little baby editor back in the 80s. And I'm thinking I was in fifth grade then. But yeah. So she worked on the Babysitter's Club books. She worked with Brett Hellquist and Daniel Handler on the Series of Unfortunate Events books, all through a long and amazing career at HarperCollins before she founded a children's imprint at Algonquin Books. And so they have been publishing children's books. I think she founded the imprint in 2010 and the first list came out in 2015. So it's still a relatively young imprint, but it doesn't feel like there are any growing pains or any startup hiccups at all. It's a lovely company. They're lovely people to work with, and I'm so happy. In the further annals of my unusual path to publication, I mean, I was following all the right steps that you are advised to take, but even so, there are occasional strange moments along the way. When we submitted the first Myrtle book, Premeditated Myrtle, Erin had a list. My agent Erin had a list of several publishers several editors that she'd worked with that she thought might be a good match for the Myrtle books. So Cheryl, as the editorial director of Lee and Low publishes multicultural books exclusively. So we knew we wouldn't be working with Cheryl again because she had moved on to sort of an entirely different sort of book than what I was writing. So Erin had a list of particular editors she was interested in submitting to, but she also put out a tweet on Twitter that said, "So excited to have this Miss Fisher style mystery series for tweens." And apparently Elise was walking down, this sounds dangerous, but she was walking down a street in Manhattan with her iPhone and reading this and immediately tweeted, "Yes, yes, send it to me, me, me." And so she is ultimately she's been a champion behind Myrtle as a series from the very beginning. And that was sort of what really sold me on working with her.
And what Erin
tweeted. So I sold a book on Twitter is basically the
yes
part of that.
And what Erin tweeted out is something that's often talked about in the writing world, which is you have to have a hook and you have to be able to sum up that hook in a sentence. And that hook then will help determine if you're the right fit for someone. And so Erin brilliantly created a hook, tweeted it out, and it hooked the right person.
And those are not easy.
No.
that is one of the things that, so this is where, you know, some kind of real college course in this would not go amiss. Would be, you know, how to really nail all those ephemeral parts of your submission process, how to write a great hook, how to write a great synopsis, how to, you know, what goes into a really good pitch. And that's something that I really enjoy doing. We've done local workshops here that we like to call pitching practice, where we bring people in who are going to be doing these meets with their with prospective editors and agents, where you need to have your elevator pitch, which if this is a term that is new to anyone in your audience, this is you are stuck in an elevator with an agent or an editor, and you have exactly the distance between the lobby and the floor the editor is getting off on to answer the question, what are you working on? And you need to be able to exactly sum up your story in like three sentences in a way that feels true to the heart of what you're writing and also sounds catchy enough to pique somebody's interest. And that is harder than writing an entire novel, frankly.
It is hard. And the times when you have that opportunity, you're talking to somebody who's basically saturated.
Yes.
They've been at a children's book writing, or if it's in the adult writing world, they've been in an adult writing conference all day. They're trying to pace themselves. They know they're going to be there for 3 or 4 days. They know that well-meaning writers are going to try to talk to them in the restroom and in the coffee line. And at the point when you can approach them, you have a person who's fairly saturated. And so it does have to be really interesting to break through the understandable brain fog that is occurring at the point when you see your opportunity to talk to this person. It may be when they're at their most exhausted.
And so while I never actually had to personally pitch the Myrtle books at an event like that, I was really glad that I had all those pitching practice events where we talk about how to hone it, how to focus on those elements that are really, really essential. And I think that so we talk about this as a sales tool, but when I give writing workshops, I talk about it as a writing tool and how having that pitch ready, even when you start writing a book, can keep you focused on what it is you're trying to write. And so if it sort of it might take a while you're getting to know your characters and starting your story, but eventually, before you finish the book, you should have a sense of what it is you're trying to write. And you should be able to articulate that in one or two quick sentences. So for Myrtle, mine was, it's a story about a 12-year-old girl who is obsessed with the new Victorian sciences of criminology. When her neighbor dies under, air quotes, mysterious circumstances, she takes it upon herself to prove that it was murder and solve the crime. And then I would follow up with, and it's called Premeditated Myrtle. And if I do say so myself, that's a great elevator pitch. That's a solid, catchy, it encompasses all of the important parts that you need. You've got your main character, your setting, your conflict. And the biggest blessing of these books was that fantastic title that I was lucky enough to hit on. So, and that's something any writer can learn how to do for their own work. And I think both as a selling tool and as a writing tool, it's an invaluable skill to have. And it probably works just as well for academic writing, if you're trying to publish an article on the latest COVID research that you've done, or what have you. It might not be quite as crucial when you're writing the drug policy for a trucking company, but you know, not at all a bad skill to have, to learn how to compress 100,000 words into 25 words.
And it can also be useful, especially for someone like you who has a writing community, who has a supportive partner at home, to, before you give them their pitch, if they've read your work, say, what would you say the pitch is? I know with my own critique group, we do that. And it's really helpful if the whole group is giving you a pitch that is not the pitch that you would say. It can help us relook at our own work, like, are the things that I think are the strongest threads really what is most engaging for the reader? Do I, you know, there can be a usefulness in asking someone else to do the pitch for you and see how close that matches to what you would actually want to say.
And that kind of feedback, having somebody who thinks like a writer and can speak to you in writer terms is really, because as you say, this is a solitary craft and you're not in the same room with your coworkers, you don't always have somebody to bounce the ideas off of, and having another person who sees your work differently. And this is really valuable. And that's again why I say also helpful that your critique group might write different genres, different types of writing than you do, because those multiple perspectives, are you can't buy that, and you can't ask for, and this is where we can start to touch on the idea of inclusion in writing and inclusion in a writing community and diversity and hearing more voices. Those things only make us stronger. So hearing, you don't want to muddy the soup of your writing with too many extraneous opinions, but knowing who to listen to and when, and opening yourself up to hearing input from people who are not you, who are not exactly like you, can show you richer, newer, more interesting avenues to take your writing in, which is going to help you grow as a writer and improve your craft, which is particularly valuable when you are writing for young readers, especially who need to have those windows opened for them.
And can you unpack for us the terms windows and mirrors when we're talking about children's writing?
So this is a term that you hear a lot from people in the children's literature community. Maybe not always from people on the writing and publishing side, but you will hear it constantly if you talk to enough teachers and librarians and you listen to them talk about engaging young readers and finding a path to help young readers grow and making a community of young readers. Children, all kinds of kids, all kinds of readers need all kinds of books. And when we talk about books that are windows and mirrors for young readers, we mean books that either show them a new aspect of life that they haven't been exposed to before, or a book that reflects back their own experiences. And so for many years, too many years, the world of children's literature was largely full of mirrors to the white middle-class American experience. And there has been a very strong push in recent years, finally, to have more mirrors, own voices books written by people with different backgrounds than white middle-class Americans to come and write stories that represent mirrors into other races' experiences, other communities, LGBTQ kids. And those are vital for young readers to see themselves. We were talking beforehand, if you can't see it, you don't know that you can be it. So, so the idea of having, we need diverse books for diverse readers. We need those books that represent the lives of all of the kids in our communities. Not only so those readers can see themselves represented in stories, but so all readers can see the lives and the experiences of people who are not just like them. I was always a windows reader. I was not in the remotest sense interested in reading about other middle-class white Midwestern kids. So I've never been a big contemporary reader fan, but if you handed me, or a contemporary fiction fan or reader, but if you handed me historical fiction or fantasy or something that took place in another country, I always wanted to know more about what it was like to live in another place, as another person, in another culture, in another time. And because there are all sorts of readers, we need all of our kids' books to reflect as much of the world as possible. And especially with the diversity of our nation is increasing, and the publishing industry has been slow to keep pace with that. And so now we're opening more and more doors, not just to writers of color, and but also the gatekeepers, the agents, the editors, the sales staff, the marketing people, the decision makers in the publishing industry. And that's also when we talk about self-publishing being more of an avenue for more writers to get in on the game. And all of these voices, those are good things. Those are important to have those, all of these voices be heard.
One of the other things that you do with your book is you are responsive to the fact that some kids read up. There's some kids need high-low books. They need high interest topics, but their reading level is gauged at being below their grade level, which is a concept that is a bit controversial among teachers because kids read at the level they read at, and it's not really pegged to age or grade, but that's what a high-low is. And then there's the idea of kids reading up where they're young, but they love a dense, meaty book. And they often then are reading a YA book when they're, an 8-year-old. And so while they're capable of reading a 300 or 400 page book, the themes of a YA book are aimed at the life experiences that would resonate with the teenager. And so the premeditated Myrtle books respond to that need, that kids who are reading up, they're dense, they have footnotes, they have asterisks, they have phrases in Latin. Can you talk about why you were drawn to creating books for kids that are reading up?
So I was, if you've read anything I've ever written, it's probably pretty clear that I was that kid that read up. And one of the stories that I like to tell is we lived in Ecuador for some time when I was a kid, and I didn't speak a lot of Spanish at the time, and we were voracious readers and very quickly moved through the very small shelf of books on the American Consulate English Library. And not to mention the very few books that we could fit in our own luggage when we moved down. And so we ran out of things to read. And everyone in the small expat community was reading, so it was 1984, and the hot book of the time that everyone was reading was Clan of the Cave Bear. And all of the adults in the community read it, and then my parents let my brother, who was, I turned 10 when we lived there, and so my brother was 13, so he read Clan of the Cave Bear, and the book was 800 pages long, and just the idea of having that many pages in English available to read, I begged and begged and begged. And finally they relented, and I read Clan of the Cave Bear when I was 10. I read it again when I was in college and an anthropology major, and thought, okay, maybe this isn't a book I would now hand a 10-year-old. Taking that experience combined with my experience as an author, I do write YA fantasy. And my books were trending darker and more violent and a little sexier. But I was getting all this fan mail from fifth and sixth graders. All of these kids who were reading Curse and Star-Crossed and Liar's Moon and really responding to the density of the prose and the complexity of the themes and the rich world building and all of the things that I do well as a writer, but they're 10 and 11 years old, and I wasn't writing books with 10 and 11 year olds in mind. I was writing about 16 and 18 year old characters. And I thought, I need to write books for these kids that meet them where they're at. And so when kids read up, you answered the question beautifully when you asked it. We often think about the fact that when kids read up, they're being exposed to themes or content that maybe we don't want. Maybe we don't want our 10-year-olds reading about the sexual lives of Neanderthals. But more important to me in that respect is exactly what you said. Even if a kid is reading up and enjoying a book that is an adult book or a YA book, those books aren't for them. They're not about them. And regardless of the mature content, the stories don't feature them. And so I love the idea of writing a story, with a really high reading level and that expects a lot from the reader and that tells the reader, you are smart enough to read this. You are smart. I trust you to follow what's going on, even if maybe you don't read Greek. You're still, I have enough respect for you as a reader to hand this to you and say, this is for you. And so that's really what I had those readers in mind with the Myrtle books. And in fact, they also resonate really well with adult readers, which makes them great books for families to share. You know, you can sneak it off your kid's nightstand, or if you've found it and read it, and say maybe you've been a fan of the Flavia Deluce books, and you read this and you say, well, here's a book that I can give my 10-year-old and not worry about that it's not going to matter to a younger reader.
They also would make great family read alouds. I came from a family where talking about the books that we read was something that we did, and also reading aloud as part of family time. But finding a book that would meet the interest of different ages, frankly, can be challenging. But these books, I think, check all those boxes.
So I had somebody posted this to me on Facebook, which I just was the most delightful thing. She and her mother, during the pandemic, have been getting together on Zoom every Sunday and reading to each other. And she said How to Get Away with Myrtle was going to be their very next book. I thought, well, how fun is that?
That's a great thing for people to add to their pandemic to-do list when they're, you know, out of the will to make any more sourdough bread. They can do Zoom, weekend Zoom family reading time. In the few minutes that we have left, I was wondering what you're working on now. Your publisher sent me Premeditated Myrtle, and then the next book, How to Get Away with Myrtle. And since it's a series, I was wondering, are you working on what comes after How to Get Away with Myrtle?
So we have almost wrapped up book three, Cold-Blooded Myrtle, which is a Christmas mystery about a cold case that Myrtle and Miss Judson solve. And I know our listeners cannot see the gorgeous covers, but I have just gotten a glimpse of the sketch of Brett Hellquist's sketch for the cover of book three, and it is glorious. I am so excited. They have made an incredible addition to the cover that I think responds to sort of fan reactions, and I just can't wait to share that. And right now I am just in the thick of book four, which is In Myrtle Peril. And that's what we have scheduled so far. And I've told my agent and my editor that really I would be happy writing Myrtle Hardcastle mysteries for the rest of my career. And my editor has said, yes, I want you on the porch of the retired author's home typing away writing Myrtle mysteries. So hopefully we've had such a tremendous response from fans and readers and from booksellers. Premeditated Myrtle was an Indie Next pick, which was a huge honor for me. And it's also been named one of Amazon's top 20 children's books of the year. So hopefully those will translate into, the less fun side of the writing life, good sales, which feed your opportunity to keep doing what it is you love. I have had fans still write to me asking when the third Thief Errant book, Star-Crossed Liar's Moon, we were originally planning three or four books in that series, and the sales did not justify Scholastic picking more up. So hopefully we're having such a tremendous response for the Myrtle books because I think of that sort of, they have, despite being for a higher reading level and having all the quirky, nerdy bits, the footnotes and the untranslated Greek and all the legal Latin, they do seem to have a pretty wide universal appeal, and hopefully that will translate into many more Myrtle mysteries that I will get to write, and I will never, ever be able to say the word murder again.
I hope that there will be many more Myrtle books to come. Thank you so much for talking with us today, Elizabeth. We've been talking about the craft of writing and the book Premeditated Myrtle. This is The Academic Life on New Books Network. I'm Dr. Christina Gessler, your host, and I hope you will please join us again.